8:30, we have here live in the studio once again, hard to believe, none other than Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Hardly had time to change from last night. So.
Is that why you look so strange?
It could be, yeah. But that's why it was hard to believe, right?
Right. I
mean, right.
Something. Just whatever. Never mind.
We had to show our ID when we came in the door.
Yeah, that's kind of like Iraq now, where they're issuing identity cards.
Yeah, for people who live in certain villages, so they can actually prove that they're supposed to be living in that village.
Yeah. Well, it's just hard to recognize you with all that chocolate smeared all over your face.
Oh, I see. No, that's not my face. That's.
I didn't think that was chocolate.
All right.
We're just going to contest everything here, because we're skeptics. Good morning,
anyway.
Mike.
Good morning.
I hate it when the chocolate freezes like this.
Don't worry, it'll melt soon.
just like our ratings. Let's jump into finishing up this week's review of how people, how you would recommend people to vote coming up this election.
Oh, yeah, that. There is an election coming around on... On Tuesday, November the 4th, vote early and vote often for your favorite candidates. And we had it all laid out on the website for Eat the State. www.eatthestate.org has all the lists, because we went through city council last week. We went through all the ballot measures and initiatives and charter amendments and blah-de-blah, House joint resolutions and blah-de-blah-de-blah last week. So we have left this week. Several of the other elected officials, specifically the county council and the Port of Seattle and the monorail board and the school board. And the school board I want to particularly mention and highlight because, in my opinion anyway, it's a really rare opportunity in Seattle politics. There are what has sort of inadvertently come to be a slate of candidates running. And these are four women who are challengers, three of them challengers to incumbents, one to a PTSA mom who is very much allied with the existing school board. None of these women actually knew each other before the campaign started, but they've essentially become a reform plank, and they're all outstanding candidates. And three of them actually won handily in the primary, and all that has happened since the primary to our already dysfunctional school board and school district is that the board made an absolute embarrassment out of the search for a superintendent. So there's more reason than ever to vote for these challengers, and several of them are not only exceptional as potential members of the school board, but I think in particular, Breida Butler-Wall and Darlene Flynn have run as good a grassroots campaign as we have seen in Seattle in a very long time. So there are four of them.
Two very competent women there.
Yeah,
Breida and Darlene.
And they've both been on this program before also, I believe.
Mm-hmm. You are correct.
And so there are four of these different positions. In position number one, we have Sally Soriano coming out of North Seattle is the challenger running against incumbent Barbara Peterson. And if folks may remember, Sally was sort of the local heroine who was responsible for much of the early organizing and public education leading up to not only the WTO ministerial meetings in 1999, but really free trade organizing.
In general,
for the last decade in the Seattle area, she's really was beating that drum long before anybody else in this region. And at the same time, has a background as a progressive educator and is running for school board against Barbara Peterson in position number one. Position number two is Darlene Flynn, coming out of the sort of Green Lake, Wallingford, North Central Seattle area, running against Steve Brown, who is chair of the Finance and Audit Committee of Seattle, is the guy who is most responsible for not happening to notice the missing $32 million, billion, whatever, trillion dollars in the school board budget. Position number three was Breida Butler-Wall running against Nancy Waldman, who is the president of the school board, who, among other things, managed to select four finalists, all of whom had extremely controversial backgrounds in the superintendent search and managed to trip that they were all, you know, passed with flying colors and there were no red flags with any of them. And she's been similarly clueless throughout her 4 years as board president. Position number six is the open position. Betty Hoagland is the PTSA mom. The challenger there, who is in the sort of reformer plank, is Irene Stewart. Irene Stewart, Sally Soriano, Breida Butler-Wall, Darlene Flynn, vote for them early and often. It really is a chance to effect a real sea change in Seattle schools, and in a way that's we rarely see an opportunity to do in Seattle politics. So I really want to encourage that very strongly. Let's see. Otherwise, we have county council. We only have a couple of competitive races on the ballot this year. In most of these races, they were either decided in the primary, or there weren't any real strong challengers in one party or the other. But there are two of particular interest over on the far east side in Issaquah and the eastern part of King County. We have Brian Drudowski running as a Democrat this time, trying to reclaim his old county council seat from David Irons, who beat him in a Republican primary 4 years ago. Drudowski has also been heavily involved in Green Party politics. He also was involved in WTO organizing, and in fact was the sole elected official at the time in 1999 who was doing a lot of good work, not just in publicizing what WTO was about, but also in trying to sort of mediate and curb police abuses during those hectic days. Drudowski has been spending his time since then involved in Green Party politics, helping out consult grassroots community groups all across the state. He's an independent voice and a very, very good person to have back on county council. So that, again, would be something to encourage. And then we have a very stark choice in the southeast part of the county, where Steve Hammond is the appointed Republican incumbent who is running against Barbara Heavey. Heavey is a Democrat, a trial lawyer. She is very good. She's articulate. She's intelligent. She represents the suburban district, I think, very well, much better than Hammond would. So those are the county council. We have the monorail board, in which there are only a couple of elected positions. And, I'm not sure whether to be encouraged or disturbed that in some ways it's very, very good, I think, that all four of the candidates for the two boards are holding their joint election night party together, because in the press release for it, they're saying, because with us, with all of us, monorail is the real winner. And, the concern that I think any of us should have about the monorail at this point, it's past. It's going to happen. It is happening. We don't need cheerleading for the monorail at this point. What we need to make sure is, because the monorail was set up as a public-private partnership where at every station along the way, not only do you have to cut deals with private developers, but the profit has to be hardwired into that deal. And you've got Joel Horn, who is, a consummate Mr. Insider, running the ship for the monorail board. What we need is accountability to make sure that the insiderism and the sort of financial hucksterism that plagued Sound Transit does not run rampant. And so this is an area where I've actually had second thoughts about both of the endorsements from the primary, simply because there's a little bit too much true believerism going on there, because of the history of the monorail. And the fact that it's the people's transit system and so forth, there gets to be this, well, it's the monorail, so it has to be wonderful, sort of aura that surrounds it, which it is sort of an invitation to abuse by some people who would want to take advantage of that, like, say, developers. So we have two of the four candidates, I think, are a little bit better suited to that kind of that kind of oversight role. Cindy Laws, in the first of the positions, sort of got all of the endorsements going in, everything from us to the to the League of Women Voters and the Democratic Party and
to
the Seattle Times and all the rest of that. But the person who survived to run against her, James Egan, is also saying a lot more about accountability. And in the other race, you have Tim Kerr, who has a background. With the state. He wants to be a financial watchdog. His background with the state is analyzing state bonds. And again, that's going to be a background that would be very, very helpful, given that's how the monorail is going to be raising a lot of its money. He's running against Cleve Stockmeyer, who, again, was with the monorail from the very beginning. So those are my recommendations, Tim Kerr and James Egan, in those two positions. Although, again, you know, the other two people running could be very good as
well.
Yeah,
and I would say also that I still support the other two people. I do think the monorail does need people who really want to get it done, because there are still elements, particularly in downtown Seattle, who would like to see the monorail project fail and have been using the excuse that the monorail has not been taking in the projected revenues that they had thought they would get as an excuse to just dump the project. And so I think it is important to still get people on the board who are interested in seeing it through to the end, so you can vote either way on these races.
Yeah, see, I have not heard that. I mean, you know, there is no way, unless the monorail project defaults, that it's not going to get built somehow. I mean, that's I don't think that's in the cards, but I mean, there's certainly people who are not enthusiastic about it.
Yeah, I actually wouldn't agree with you. I mean, Sound Transit has come very close to falling through in spite of having similar kinds of support.
But the reason Sound Transit has come close to falling through is because the federal funding for it came close to being blocked, and there is no federal funding for the monorail.
Well, but that's the point here. The point is that the local funding is not there in the way that it was supposed to be there, and that's what critics are using to try to undermine the monorail. So I think it is important to still have people who really want to see the project through to the end on the board.
All right. Port of Seattle.
Yeah, we have for the port a couple of different races, again, where you have as with the school board incumbents who are very heavily entrenched, and I have to say one of them, Bob Edwards, who ran as a reformer 4 years ago and has been pretty much a disappointment from the get-go. I mean, he really has been voting with the majority on the board, and the Port of Seattle, for anybody who's followed it for any length of time, may well be one of the most corrupt government entities in the Puget Sound region. I mean, there really is a tremendous amount of insiderism with the cruise lines and with the container companies that ship through there, and taxpayers having to you know, pick up costs the corporation should be picking up for themselves.
Yeah, and a whole effort to privatize what should be public assets at the port as well.
Yeah, and also de-unionize the jobs as
exactly.
Well. So you have two incumbents running, Claire Nordquist and Bob Edwards, and they are running against two people who we felt should deserve the votes for that. And I'm drawing a complete blank on their names at the moment, which is not a good sign. Tim Baker, I know, is one. And but I'm trying to remember who the other one was. Oh, dear. This is kind of embarrassing. Don't be dumb. Don't we have, like, background theme music that we can...
We do, but not for this
I'm not
going to
bail you out.
Yeah, we can run here from... No, I had it right here in front of me and underlined, and now I'm not seeing it in front of my face. We have monorail, we have school district, we have initiative measure. Don't say we didn't forget to run the port in here. Maybe we did. That would be really bad.
Well, so clearly we need to get the incumbents out in the
yes, but that's not... Oh, dear. This is, like, I think the first time I've ever done this.
Who was the editor of this issue?
Actually, Troy was. Here it is. It's on the front page. Jim Baker and Alec Fiskin. There we go. Oh, yes. And by the way, because Troy was the editor in Mexico, we need to fix an error that was in Eat the State this time that wasn't in the endorsements, but it was elsewhere in the issue. Dick Lilly is not running for re-election on the school board, so we can clarify any confusion that might be there for folks. But, yeah, Jim Baker and Alec Fiskin are the names of the challengers in the point. It's on the front page, which is why I couldn't find it. you always look for the important stuff on the inside, but it was right there in the front page. So Jim Baker and Alec Fiskin running as challengers, and both of them have emphasized financial accountability and all those other kind of good things for the Port of Seattle.
All right. Well, let us move along. I saw... I think it was in yesterday's paper. It might have been in the day before. Both the Times and the PI have brought out that apparently the economy is recovering. We're back to a rocketing skyrocketing numbers.
It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood.
It only takes one number.
A wonderful day in the neighborhood.
And, it only takes one statistic to get everybody's hopes up, it appears.
Well, but, one carefully selected statistic. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. The PI's headline was interesting. It was surging economy shifts into high gear, and I saw that.
So it was
that.
Already surging, right?
I know. I saw that, and I said, "Oh, really?" What that's based on is it's based on one statistic that looked at spending, consumer and business spending, for the last quarter, which was July, August, and September of this year. And it was about double what they had expected it would be. Now, there's a reason for that, and that's the consumer spending was boosted because of the tax cut checks that people got in the mail. If you'll recall, the Bush tax cut, most of it went to very wealthy Americans, but a little bit was given back to people who have children and can qualify for the child tax credit. And so people got checks of around $400 or so. And they went out, as you would expect, and they bought items that they needed that they'd been putting off for the last 2.5 years because we've been in a recession. Now, businesses have been doing the same thing.
So tax cuts do stimulate the economy?
For about 2, maybe 3 months.
Okay.
And most people who have looked at the impact of the Bush tax cuts say that they think it's about over. The impact that it's going to have on the economy, that people have gotten their checks and gotten their tiny little amounts a little bit less withheld from their paychecks, and that's going to settle in now, and people are going to start spending it on necessities rather than luxury items, and that the impact of the tax cut is pretty much over at this point, and it's reflected in this single statistic that has come out. Now, businesses have been spending a little more, too, but it's on, like, computer equipment upgrades, things that businesses have to spend on every 2 to 3 years, and businesses have been putting that off for long enough that now is kind of the time when they have to make those upgrades. It's not something that they're choosing to do just because they have the extra cash laying around. Now, another indicator that people have been citing for the economy picking up is the corporate profit announcements that have been made. Now, at the end of every quarter, major corporations release their financial data, and they make their announcement of how much their profits or their losses were for the previous quarter. And in October, they've been looking better than most analysts had expected. Now, the reason for that is pretty simple. In the last quarter, last year, I would say, or longer, corporations have been cutting their costs. And the main way that they cut their costs is by laying people off. Now, that will have an immediate short-term impact on their profits. It means that they will show that they have a profit in the short term. But you can't continue, as a company, you can't continue to lay people off in order to show a profit, because eventually you're not going to have any employees left. So it's a very short-term blip, in other words. And most of the analysts who really know something look at this statistic that, you know, that the economic happy talk people are going crazy over, and they say, well, that's just this one quarter, and it's not going to be the same next quarter or the quarter after or the quarter after. So in other words, the economic slump is going to continue for a while, particularly because the job picture is so bad.
Yeah, the other thing that you run into with the jobs is that, you know, companies have been trying to save money this way for several years now, that they've been squeezing and then squeezing a little more and a little more, at least the last couple of years.
The last 2 years in particular.
Yeah, and they, you know, you can only do that for so long. At some point, the only way that you can save labor costs is by starting to ship jobs overseas, which we're also
seeing.
Which
is what they're doing right now. That's what this increase in productivity indicator that they're always discussing is all about. Companies are cutting jobs here in the United States, jobs that pay fairly well, laying people off, and they're shipping those jobs overseas to places where that same work can be done by somebody for far less money. That's what increase in productivity means these days. It means shipping jobs overseas.
Yeah, and so in that sense, when you see that statistic and you see at the same time, well, the job situation is going to improve, those are mutually exclusive. I mean, to a large extent, not entirely, but
yeah,
they work against each other.
Yeah, you don't have a productivity increase in the way that economists mean it at the same time as you have an increase in jobs in the economy. Now, the problem with continuing to have layoffs in this last quarter that had this uptick in corporate profits, we saw 41,000 people lose their jobs, adding to the some 2 to 3 million people who have lost their jobs since Bush took office. Now, when you have people continuing to lose their jobs and then just a few of them being hired back at minimum wage or at temp jobs, what you have is people who have no income security. And when you have a larger and larger and larger portion of the population without income security, then consumer spending suffers, and it's consumer spending that drives economic recovery. So that's going to be a problem for a long time in the future. And so this little blip in these one or two statistics is not evidence of the economy shifting into high gear, not at all evidence of the economy shifting into high gear. So that's your little dose of economic unhappy talk for the morning.
And you really have to question why it is. And I mean, we keep talking about this in this program over and over for, like, it seems year in and year out. Why is it that you have all of these news reports over and over and over again trying desperately to find tea leaves that'll tell them what they apparently want to be able to tell audiences that we want to hear?
Is wishful thinking.
Yeah.
It's the idea that if you hype it enough, it'll happen.
Okay. Well, darn, I was.
So save those little miniature candy bars from last night. We might want to recycle them next year.
Okay. Well, let's move along to This Week in Iraq, and we have some of our fans in the UK have put together
internet listeners
a little piece for potential intro music, and I'd like to throw it at you right now. Here it comes.
Get ready for the biggest one night event ever to hit the town.
This Week in Iraq.
And that comes to us from the UK.
Ooh.
That's pretty. I think it's pretty cool that somebody made something. You know,
that's kind of remarkable.
So go ahead and let us know what
and
you think about
thank
that.
Thank you, by the
thank
way,
you.
For
yes,
sending that in.
That was
in.
Wonderful.
That,
was,
that is just totally blows me away that someone would do that. So let us know what you think. 206-520-5838 and register your vote. Should we keep it thumbs up or thumbs down? So Maria, tell us,
Meanwhile, what
did transpire this week in Iraq?
Well, what I noticed the most this week in Iraq is the disconnect between the reality of what's actually going on in Iraq versus what the U.S. officials are saying. Now, there's two big myths that we heard out of the mouths of people like Paul Bremer, the U.S. viceroy in Iraq, and the Central Command in Qatar, and out of George Bush's mouth, and Colin Powell, and Donald Rumsfeld, and Paul Wolfowitz. And the first of those two myths is that the security situation in Iraq is improving. Now, it was very, very obvious this week that that's not true.
And in fact, if you even want to look at the Seattle Times this morning, today, Saturday morning, there's like four different stories involving attacks upon American troops in Iraq, none of which make reference to another. I mean, you can't keep up with them all.
Yeah,
right now,
very true that you can't keep up with them.
But we're
all
seeing that more and more in U.S. media. It's getting
as
covered
well.
More.
It's
and
starting
more
to leak
yeah.
through to the newspapers. I don't know if it's getting on the Fox News network, but it's certainly in the newspapers. Now, it started on Sunday. Terrible, bloody week that we've had this week in Iraq started in Sunday with the 8 to 10 rockets hitting the Al Rashid Hotel and nearly killing Paul Wolfowitz, the number two man at the Pentagon. And the next day there were a number of car bombings, 200 people injured, almost 40 people killed in four car bombings, including the bombing of the Red Cross headquarters in Baghdad. And it's continued with bombings and mortar attacks and grenade attacks and riots throughout Baghdad and the Sunni Triangle.
And a threatened general strike for today through Tuesday.
You have to read quite extensively to get a broad picture of this. I've noted that Robert Fisk, the British journalist for the Independent newspaper in the UK, actually has reported quite a bit about what he's been able to see as he's moved through Iraq. I read a couple of reports of his this week, and he reported that the Baghdad International Airport gets shot, that planes that are landing and taking off at the Baghdad International Airport get shot at by surface-to-air missiles nearly every night. Yeah. And he was quoting an American engineer who works at the airport saying that to him as he was trying to leave the country. Certainly the landing strip is under mortar attack multiple times a day. And U.S. Special Forces troops told him while he was at the Baghdad International Airport that there used to be a 5-mile perimeter around the airport. That's now down to 2 miles, which means that Iraqi guerrillas have actually been defeating U.S. efforts to maintain security around the Baghdad International Airport, and they're now within mortar and surface-to-air missile range and shoulder-fired missile range of planes trying to take off and land there.
Yeah, you're not getting regular commercial flights into Baghdad at this point.
And we're certainly not hearing that in the U.S. media.
Yeah. And Fisk is filing 3 or 4 times a week at least right now, and I highly recommend his reports for people who have access to them over the Internet.
He and other reporters as well, including AP reporters, Reuters reporters, etc., have said that U.S. troops are coming under attack about 35 times a day just in the Baghdad area alone. We're lucky if we hear about 1 or 2 attacks in which a soldier died. We're not hearing about the enormous other casualties, the wounded people who in previous wars would have died if it weren't for the would have died but aren't dying now because we have these heroic medical measures that we can do now to save their lives. People whose lives will be changed forever because they've lost limbs, are now paraplegics, etc. These are our U.S. troops who are still casualties of the war that we're not hearing about.
And the Iraqi civilians, of course, are not getting that kind of medical care.
And no one is. And no one is counting the number of Iraqi civilians who are injured or killed, like in the 4 bombing attacks that happened on Monday. Just enormous numbers of civilian Iraqis were killed and injured, and they're simply not being counted. Now, Robert Fisk also reported that in one evening's drive from Tikrit to Baghdad last week, he saw 13 separate U.S. bases under mortar attack. This is another thing that's not being reported in the U.S. media, are nightly mortar bombings of U.S. bases. Now, the guerrillas are not exactly accurate with their mortars. A lot of them miss. A lot of the time, the mortar attacks simply serve to keep troops awake and damage morale. But when they do hit, troops, it causes a lot of damage because nobody sleeps with their helmet and their flak jackets and their body armor on. So this is another thing that we're not hearing in the U.S. media, is that instead of just being a few mortar rounds shot once in a while, it's a nightly barrage in most parts of the Sunni Triangle and in other parts of Iraq as well.
Yeah, and the other thing we're not hearing is that Fisk and others have written about is that U.S. troop morale is horrible right now. I mean, they are working under desperate conditions. They're not trained for what they're doing. And they don't know why they're there, and they resent Washington for putting them there.
Now, the second myth I want to talk about briefly is all of our commanders keep saying, "Well, it's foreign terrorists who are doing this." Excuse me, but if you listen to and you read what comments the commanders on the ground are making, it's entirely the opposite. Brigadier General Martin Dempsey of the 1st Armored Division based in Baghdad said on Monday, quote, "We have not seen any infusion of foreign fighters in Baghdad," end quote.
Period.
Major General Raymond Odierno of the 4th Infantry Division based in the Sunni Triangle north of Baghdad and around Tikrit said, quote, "What I found is Iraqis do not like people from other countries fooling in Iraqi business." Of course, he didn't extend this to the U.S. occupation forces. But he went on to say, quote, "They don't like Iranians here. They don't like Syrians. They really like their own people being involved in this." That's what he said. They really like their own people being involved in this. Now, he went on to say, too, that U.S. troops haven't captured many foreign fighters. Quote, "A couple from Syria, some Wahhabists from other countries, but that's really been it. We have not seen a large influx of foreign fighters thus far." And he claimed that it was less than 5% of the people engaging in attacks against their troops might be from Syria or might be Wahhabists from places like Saudi Arabia.
So Robert Fisk is a good person to look into.
Robert Fisk is a good person to read. If you can read some of the Associated Press and Reuters, Reuters reports off the news wire, that's much better than getting your news through the newspaper or other filtered
sources.
And
he's going to be actually featured on TUC Radio tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. So.
And then one other quick plug that I wanted to put in, because we had said we were going to talk about district elections, but we didn't. But KOW had a good program on that on Weekday yesterday. So that's on the web that they have archived there for people who want to check that out.
All right. We are talking today with John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors of Eat the State. And very quickly tell people where they can find Eat the State.
It has its election stuff this time. It's free around town, but bookstores and cafes. You can find it on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, tips, comments, feedbacks, the voicemail is 206-903-9461.